Third case for oral argument this morning is Samina Gull, M.D., appellant versus the Center for Family Medicine, and Dr. Earl Kemp, appellees. For the appellant, we have Mr. Sean Nichols, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the appellees, we have Mr. Stephen Morgans and Ms. Dana Van Beek Palmer, attorneys from Sioux Falls. I understand, Mr. Morgans, you'll be presenting the argument this morning. Very well. The court should further note that Justice Sabers has disqualified himself from this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable David Gienap, presiding judge of the Third Circuit here in Brookings, to sit in his place. With that, Mr. Nichols, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson, members of the Supreme Court Counsel. May it please the Court, again for the record, my name is Sean Nichols. I represent Dr. Samina Gull in her claim against Center for Family Medicine. Before I begin, I wanted to just thank the members of the audience for also being here. Not too long ago, myself, I had the opportunity to sit through my civics class, and that's how I gathered the interest to become a lawyer. And so whether they're compelled to be here or not, they're better off for it. The facts of this case, is postured before the court on a grant of summary judgment by the trial court in favor of the defense and appellees. The claims are breach of contract and due process. I believe the court erred as a matter of law in granting summary judgment and asked the court to reverse. The facts that set this case up for decision began in 2004. Dr. Samina Gull was seeking a residency program and through a match process ended up being selected to complete her residency training at the Center for Family Medicine in Sioux Falls. The Center for Family Medicine is a nonprofit organization that receives public funding in order to operate, and I believe the record and even the appellee's brief is clear on that point. In the process of the residency program, Dr. Gull signed a contract. The residency is 3 years in family medicine, but a contract is executed each year with the expectation that each resident will complete the three-year program. Dr. Gull's contract began in June of 2004 and was to continue until the end of June of 2005, where, again, the expectation would be that she would sign a contract for an additional year and then an additional year until she was licensed to practice family medicine.
Did this contract promise her any employment with the center beyond her residency?
No, absolutely not. But I do think the contract, and that was my next point, is the basis for the issues before the court. The contract itself makes very clear that the resident manual applies as well to the terms of the expectations for both the resident and for the program itself. The contract says that the resident manual defines the duties and privileges of the resident as well as the governing rules, regulations, policies, and procedures of his or her employment with CFM.
Now, you aren't saying that she has a contractual right for 3 years,
no.
Or are you? Okay.
No, not at all. Our argument, and kind of just to cut to the chase, is that the resident manual says very plainly that she's entitled to notice of a proposed dismissal and an opportunity to be heard.
She did get a notice, though.
What's that?
You're not disputing that. She did, in fact, get a notice of dismissal.
What I dispute is that she was terminated before her first-year contract was up. And I think that's the way to look at it. The trial court didn't look at it that way. He said, basically, that what the decision in April of 2005 by Center Family Medicine was not to renew her second-year contract. It was more than that. They terminated her employment.
So what do you contend, then, is the genuine issue of material fact here?
Well, we believe that she was fired without an opportunity to be heard, as the resident manual provides. I think it says very clearly that she is to be provided notice before the dismissal is made and an opportunity to present herself. What happened here is they said, we're giving you notice that in writing that we're not going to renew your second-year contract. But in addition to that, I think the facts show, and again, we're here on the summary judgment standard, where all inferences from the facts are in favor of the non-moving party, must be construed in favor of the non-moving party. And I think from the facts, there's a fair inference that this was more than just saying, hey, we're not going to renew your contract for a second year, but instead saying, you're done today.
Okay, what had happened if they had said, well, we're not going to renew your contract, you will be paid through the end of the year, but we don't want you to come back?
I think that would have been appropriate, but the important thing to understand here is because they terminated her without completion of a first year, and I think if you look at the records in particular, there is a letter from Mercy Medical Center of Merced, and Dr. Gall sought employment with other institutions. That document indicates very clearly that Dr. Gall, thank you for applying to our program, but based on what happened with Center for Family Medicine, it appears to us that maybe you'd be more suited for another program. And I think from that it shows that this decision to terminate her before she had a chance to finish the first year really set the ball rolling and put her in a position where she became unemployable within the residency program. Additional thing to consider as part of this is the April 27 letter, which Center for Family Medicine contends is when they gave notice that they were not going to renew her contract, also says very clearly that we will discuss going forward in June the opportunity for you to perhaps do some type of remedial program to complete your first year. And again, completion of the first year is absolutely critical here because now what she has is at least something to show for her efforts at Center for Family Medicine as opposed to when they just said, turn in your badge, your pager, your keys, you're done. She's got nothing to show except that she's been in the program for 10 months and didn't get any credit for it and didn't complete it,
but
too.
After the April 27th letter, she went before the ROC and then the CFM Board of Directors, right?
That is true.
And if they would have reversed, she'd have had her job, right?
Well, that's true, but I think, again, the distinction that is absolutely critical here is we're not talking about a decision, and what was in front of the ROC was merely a question of whether she could get the opportunity to go forward to a second year, an opportunity for a second-year contract. And again, this happened after the April 27 letter and the conversation with Dr. Kemp where he said maybe you'd be better off going somewhere else. And within a week, she was told to turn in her badge and her pager and then taken off her rotation. So I think there's a big distinction to be made because she has a property right and a property interest in a first-year contract. That's what we're talking about here, the decision to terminate that first-year contract, which was not subject to any ROC review at all. The question before the ROC was the second-year contract. I think that gets us both under a due process claim and a contract claim in a separate set of facts, a different set of facts than what the trial court really looked at when deciding to grant summary judgment in favor of the defendants.
So what is the remedy here that you're seeking?
The remedy is under common and statutory law, damages, and that's a question of fact. As we cite in our brief, and under the statute 21-2-1, and then Marriott versus First National Bank of Eden, this court has said that damages is a question of fact, and I believe that this case should be remanded to the jury, to have a jury decide what the amount of the damages are. Now, the trial court, as you note from the trial court's letter decision, indicates in the very last paragraph that she's entitled to payment for whatever was left, the balance of what was owed under the first-year contract. I believe there's consequential damages to her that exceed just what she was expected to be paid under that contract because she did become unemployable after this decision was made and after it was made without first giving her a notice and an opportunity to defend herself. And again, I think if you go back and you look at the record, particularly that April 27 letter of Dr. Kemp, it indicates that, to the contrary of what actually happened, that this isn't the end. There's still a chance for her to do some remedial coursework for the rest of the first-year contract, and perhaps in June we'll revisit this and she'll have an opportunity to complete her first-year contract. Again, that is, as I understand it, in the medical residency program, absolutely essential. Without that, again, she's left trying to get a job, get into a residency program, without or having to explain why she's got nothing to show for her first year.
She did have an opportunity, obviously, in these subsequent hearings to present her case. And what you're asking is a very technical reading of that policy handbook, in that she should have received a hearing prior to being dismissed. Am I understanding your argument?
That's absolutely right.
And so you don't think that the hearings afterwards were sufficient to meet a due process standard?
Here's a couple of important points to remember about that. First of all, Dr. Kemp, the one who made this decision in writing and then to the contrary suggested that maybe you should quit now, was the one that was chairing all these hearings. Second of all, as the United States Supreme Court held in Armstrong versus Manzo, and the breach of contract and due process claims essentially come out of the same nucleus of facts here, but they make very clear, if you are provided or are supposed to have due process, the United States Supreme Court says, the fact that it was technically done incorrectly doesn't matter. The judiciary can't step in and craft some kind of remedy. We got to go back. I mean, they did it wrong, and that's the only thing that this court, I believe, under the law, needs to ask in this case.
So you don't want specific performance. You don't want the second and third year. You want damages.
Well, I think that specific performance, well, I move for summary judgment as well. We move for summary judgment on the basis that we think that the contract is very clear. And under the Butterfield case, which this court said that the employee handbook becomes part of the contract, that they didn't follow their contract. And I think that we are entitled to judgment as a matter of law on the contract question. And the only issue really to be decided in this case is what the damages are. And I think even the trial court, although incorrectly reaching the result, acknowledges that something wasn't quite right at the way that the process was handled here. And again, I think if you just, I know it's kind of a bulky paragraph, but the paragraph, I guess if you look at it this way, if Center for Family Medicine is simply able to say, we are not going to renew your contract going forward, and you can have a hearing after that, and we can talk about it, but we've already made up our mind, we're not going to change it anyway. What is the purpose of having this contractual due process? It doesn't make sense. And again, it says when a resident is being considered for dismissal. Here, I would argue the facts show, and again, under the standard, viewing it in favor of my client, that she was dismissed before there was any type of hearing. And if you read the entire paragraph, it makes clear that the hearing is to occur within 7 days, that the hearing will be in front of
Does it change the facts at all that she did receive in December a notice of unsatisfactory performance? This is 5 months before she got this notice of non-renewal. Does that change it at all?
I do not believe so. Again, that notice doesn't say you're being considered for dismissal. This is something that's more in the nature of an academic observation. And I think if you read the cases discussing the due process side of this claim, there's a compelling distinction to be made between the academic side of a resident as opposed to the employment side. It's an interesting issue, but medical residents really are a hybrid. On one set, they're there for training purposes, and there is an academic component to what they do, but the contract that I referred to, and it's page 89 in the record, says that my client is being paid $41,000 a year for her work. So there's clearly a component that exceeds any type of academic instruction in this case, and I think that when you look at that and study, okay, what are we here challenging? It's not the academic side. What we're claiming here is that we had a property interest that arose in contract, that she would be notified before being terminated, and the contract wasn't followed. And
so your complaint is that she was in fact fired when she got this notice of non-renewal, which if it had been followed according to the contract, she would have stayed on for another month or so. Were there any facts in the record to indicate that there was an exigent circumstance, that she maybe presented a danger to the patients that would indicate that they had to let her go before her contract expired?
Certainly not before this court, and arguably what was before the trial court.
Okay. Were there any? Was there? I haven't read the entire contract. I certainly will, but I'd like to know if you have. You can give me a provision in the contract where there is a clause that says if the doctor presents a danger, or if there's some other kind of misconduct, there can be an immediate termination. Is there anything like that in there?
Not that I saw in this contract, certainly as a policy consideration. That just makes good sense in the practice of medicine. But again, we don't have anything in the record here that would indicate that Dr. Gall is an immediate danger to any of the patients.
I think the third paragraph of the contract says that CFM retains the right to terminate this contract at any time should the resident, in the opinion of CFM, fail to act within his or her best professional capacity.
I understand that provision, and I think that's a little bit different than what Justice Kohlenkamp raised as far as some immediate danger to the patient. But again, under the Butterfield case, they can bargain away their at-will employment here by indicating through an employee handbook that there's a different set of due process that's required here. And so I don't think that paragraph, which Justice Giemanther...
Was that paragraph invoked in this case, do you know, that the termination at any time paragraph?
No, not that I've seen at all. In
the
fact,
notice of non-renewal suggests that there's going to be a completion in the first year.
In fact, if you look at the letters that Dr. Kemp authored to the RLC saying, hey, here's what we're considering, he makes explicit reference to the fact that this is in following our due process. I think it's 119 in the record. He refers to it as our due process protocol within the employee handbook.
If the termination contract had been, termination provision had been invoked, were there also due process hearing rights in connection with that, too?
Well, dismissal and termination, in my view, are essentially the same thing.
Right, but I mean, is this so? Okay, so the due process goes with the notice of non-renewal. Does a due process right to appeal the decision of for termination also come with the rights to hearings?
I would think a fair reading of the employee handbook, if there's due process for a non-renewal, that would certainly include termination. I think there's no other way to read the contract, frankly.
So then if they did, in fact, terminate her, why then, I mean, if they did, in fact, terminate her, as you're arguing that they did, and she got the due process hearings, where is the wrong then?
Again, the termination here occurred 5 to 6 weeks before the hearing. And according to the contract, they're supposed to give her that hearing before the termination. For someone who speaks English as a second language, did not have a lawyer present with her on April 27 when the decision was made, that makes all the difference in the world. To have a lawyer present to advocate her position when the heavy hand is dropped. And I think that...
But she still got paid for May. You say terminated, but she was getting salary but not working, right?
It's kind of an interesting question, but it is part of the record, and I think page 119... there's a letter that Dr. Kemp authored to South Dakota Department of Labor saying Dr. Gall quit on April 27 of 2005 as a kind gesture to her. We paid her another month. Didn't pay her all the contract, but gave her another month to help her out, apparently, out of goodwill. But I think, again, looking at that from a question of what is she owed under the contract.
2 minutes.
If we give her the remaining $4,000 or whatever it is for the last 4 weeks of her contract, then everything's fine here. I don't think you can logically get to that point again, because what this court has said and what we've said under statute is that you're entitled to all damages that are a consequence of the other party's breach of contract. And the damages here, because she has been unemployable for a number of years, are much more than simply the $4,000 she lost out at on this contract. Again, if they had followed their contract and given her an opportunity to have an attorney present and advocate for her position before making this decision, instead of putting themselves in a situation where we're not going to change our mind for any reason at all, it would have made all the difference in the world to her going forward, and potentially could have led to either a remediational year in the program, maybe even an opportunity for a second year in the program. But certainly, I think that a jury could construe the facts as one where she would be employed today and immediately after this decision was made in 2005. I see my time is up.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Nichols. Mr. Morgans, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, counsel. Again, my name is Steve Morgans. With Dana Van Beek Palmer, we represent Center for Family Medicine and Dr. Earl Kemp. As a result of the, we're here before you as after the summary judgment was granted on three causes of action that was pursued by Dr. Gould during, or as a result of the departure from the residency program. She has not pursued an appeal of defamation action, but obviously we're here on the breach of contract appeal as well as the due process appeal.
You spend a lot of time talking about the status as an employee versus a student. Do we even need to go there?
Your Honor, I don't believe you really have to get there because even under the higher standard, even if she was considered an employee, and we think the cases say differently, but even under the status of an employee, when you look at what the due process that's required throughout those cases, we feel that when you look at the notice of the deficiencies and the opportunity to respond to those deficiencies or have hearings on those deficiencies, that the record has shows that she was provided more than the due process that is required even at the higher threshold level of an employee. This case is about a resident that it is not in, there is no factual dispute that it was the Center of Family Medicine's determination that she did not fit the level of standards of a first-year medical resident. This started early on in her tenure where she was provided feedback. She was provided evaluations. Eventually that led to, in December of 2004, she had a notice of unsatisfactory performance. Now, this is significant because this is actually being placed on academic probation where she has special monitoring. She has specific goals that she needs to improve upon. And she has an opportunity to sit down at that time of probation with a supervisor and Dr. Kemp to talk about the areas that she needs to improve upon. In addition to the probation, after that time frame into the spring of 2005, Dr. Gould has continuing evaluations, all of which don't get to the level of where she's meeting expectations. In other words, there's numerous ones in the evaluations. They rate them on either meeting expectations, exceeds expectations, or not meeting expectations. It's generally the system, while she has several areas where she's not meeting expectations. On April 6th of 2005, she has a meeting kind of as a review of her probationary status with Dr. Kemp. And in there, you will see when you look at the actual notice of non-renewal, at that document, they quote part of what was covered at this April 6th meeting. At this April 6th meeting, there's discussions about her continued deficiencies, the fact that she's still not meeting the requirements of a first-year student, and the fact that it's likely she is not going to get to be able to complete the first year of a residency contract.
Is the document on tab B in your, is that the one you're talking about? On your brief? Notice of non-renewal of resident contract? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, Your Honor.
And there's like a box in here that has comments. And that is the way the document actually looked?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's exactly what I was referencing. And if you read around that, it talks about restating what was discussed and provided at the April 6th meeting. And the point being is that this wasn't a situation where we have a medical resident that all of a sudden on April 27th of 2005 was presented with, was blindsided by the fact that her contract was not going to be renewed. There was evaluations and notice all the way through that year of work of hers, and she had she should not have been surprised by that April 27th notice.
But is that the test? I mean, it sounds to me as if you're saying that that your client followed the spirit of the contract, but not the letter of the contract. She was entitled, if I understand correctly, she was entitled to a notice of non-renewal, and that only indicated that she won't be coming back for the second year. It doesn't mean that she's immediately terminated. But that sounds like what happened here is that she got the notice that she wasn't coming back next year, but at the same time, they took her badge and everything else that made her a resident.
And just so I'm clear, and I've kind of given a general introduction, but we do not believe that the contract was breached in regards to what was required when it says when a resident is being considered for dismissal, that the center shall notify the resident in writing of the charges and propose dismissal. We believe that that's what we did. That's what Center for Family Medicine did to or for Dr. Gould. I want to speak a little bit to your question as to what happened as of April 27th, because she's provided with this document. There's discussions with Dr. Kemp about this document. And then after that, while it's Appley's position that there's no genuine issue of material fact as to that there's not any evidence that she was actually terminated, it is a little confusing what happens after that date, because if you read Dr. Kemp's testimony and Dr. Gould's testimony in the record, she has a limited portion about the timing of what happened. But it's clear that there's a mix of her being sick and being told she can take some time off and then coming back and finding people that are covering her rotations. But what you don't find is any direct evidence, because you mentioned the fact that there is, she was told to turn in her badge. Well, and told to turn in her badge and also her keys and her dictation, etc. Well, first of all, that the reference from that comes from, the first reference from that comes from the findings from the Department of Labor on the Unemployment Division. And it's our position that you cannot consider those findings to support another case. In fact, that's what South Dakota statutory law determines at 61.7-24. But even more important than that, even when you, if you actually read the Department of Labor decision, it actually states that her departure from employment was actually the result of confusion or lack of communication from between the parties.
Well, you say you quit. By reading it correctly, you say Dr. Gull could have finished out the term of her first year contract, but instead chose to quit. He's saying she was fired. You're saying she quit. Why is that not a question of fact?
Well, it's our position. Dr. Kemp testified that he never terminated her, so there is a dispute as to whether he said you're terminated. What you don't have on the other side is Dr. Gould testifying that he told me I was fired. What happened was after this confusion, after these ensuing days and week, after this April 27th note, and she advised them that I don't feel well, and obviously this was a lot of stress in her life, and there's even a medical record in the record itself about her going in to be seen. But what happens is, after these confusing days, she comes in and says, in her testimony says, Dr. Kemp, what am I supposed to do? And her response is, Dr. Kemp told her this, you know, turn in your keys and so forth. There's nothing in there where there's no affidavit or testimony where she says, well, what do you mean? Am I being fired if there is any confusion? I think the record's pretty that at most it was a misunderstanding that CFM thought she quit. She may have thought they're letting me go because somebody was covering my rotation. But So there is some confusion on the actual what happened after the notice of non-renewal. But you have to keep in mind that when she was given this notice of non-renewal of contract, she was notified that as of June 30th, 2005, she was not going to be coming back this next year. It was for a future time frame. And as a practical matter, the circuit court in this case, the only gap between what she would have been entitled to under that contract, because she was paid for May, that was, I think, was acknowledged in oral argument and in the briefs, was the last month of her contract, and where she fought the unemployment benefits and received some. But the circuit court in this case awarded judgment to Dr. Gruhl that last month anyways, and for practical purposes, and it came about it at oral argument, counsel for CFM essentially said to Judge Cirska that, Your Honor, if it means that this case is resolved by acknowledging that she would be paid one more month of salary, I'm sure my clients would be happy with it. That's the circumstances surrounding why we get that ruling of allowing that last month of salary. But it's our position that there's no affirmative evidence to say that she was terminated. At most, what we have is her subjective belief that she was terminated. But even so, she was given the full extent of her contract through the award of this case, which we have not cross-appealed before this court.
Now, just for a point of, if you don't finish your residency program, you can't practice medicine. Is that right? So she would have to either complete this someplace else or take a different residency. Is that what happens then?
That's my understanding, Your Honor. And appellees acknowledge that the position where she was at that point, when from an academic standpoint, they said, we're not going to be able to essentially allow you to complete that first year. We're not going to renew you for, I mean, not, they said she's not going to be able to finish the first year on time. I want to be specific on that. And that she would not be renewed for the next year. That does put her in a bind as far as profession. And in fact, the discussions about, I don't think there's anything in the record that I've ever been aware of that Dr. Kemp specifically told her she should quit. There was some discussions about she may be better off starting over in another program. And in fact, he indicated because she was dealing with some family issues with her husband sick in California, which I think comes out in the medical record, on the certified record, he's essentially saying, you know, programs may better understand the fact that you're away from your support system, you were had difficulties being away from that, and that's why you need to start fresh, and that it's almost better than finishing up and not getting a completion of your first year approval. So, long answer to a short question, but.
But they would have allowed her to redo her first year. Is that in the evidence?
As of April 27th of 2005, they would have allowed her to do that, I believe. And that would be at certified record 89. Because they do discuss the fact of her still taking remedial courses at that point in time.
But it says in the notice that it would be in her best interest to repeat her first year of residency in another community. So they're not suggesting they do it there.
Yeah, and I think they did. I think that was their conclusion, is that because of, and I didn't go into it in detail about the circumstances of her deficiencies, but there were trust issues with other residents, with nurses, with physicians in her evaluations. They're basically saying it's a little harder to repeat a first year now when you've got people already acknowledging that you need to work and improve to be a physician, that we're going to allow you to treat patients. I wanted to point out specifically, and I know it's on certified record 89, but a couple of things that she was told at that April 6 meeting was, number one, she was not going to, at that time, she was not going to be able to successfully complete her first year. They also say that they're not even sure if she's going to be able to develop skills to apply basic clinical knowledge to see patients, even with this remedial help they're discussing. And really significant that they basically tell her at that point that progress in these areas that they cover in this April 6th meeting are going to be reassessed in June to determine whether she'll be given an opportunity to repeat a modified first year in the program. So I think it's really difficult for appellants to argue that she was not given that notice of the possibility that she was going to be non-renewed when we have all the discussions. This is after she's been on probation, after poor evaluations, that she would not realize as of April 6th that, you know what, we may not bring you back next year. And frankly, if they do adhere to their argument that by technically reading that the handbook, that she was required to have these hearings before the decision was final, then it's our position, Your Honors, that this April 6th notice, she should have invoked the procedures at that point, because she would have known at that point that, boy, I should know that I may not be able to continue on.
The fact they'd already made up their mind prior to any hearings, is that significant in determining whether or not she actually received due process?
In regards to the due process?
To not renew or to dismiss her. Does that figure in?
Your Honor, I don't believe so, in that when you look at the process that she had, the procedure that she had after that, and in fact, when you look at the actual notice, they're recommending that she's going to be, I mean, they say that they're giving her notice that she will not be non-renewed as of June. The question becomes, if they had put in a word in there saying, we're recommending non-renewal, what would have been different at those hearings that she went through at three different levels with over 30 different physicians, medical employees, people that observe residents? What would have been, what different would have been presented by Dr. Gu at that point? And again, when you look at...
Is that her burden of proof?
I'm sorry.
Is that her burden of proof to show that there'd be something different, a different outcome?
Well, I think the fundamental question is still whether she had adequate process, and it's just simply a point of CFM that there's a complaint that this prevented her from having adequate process, and yet we know that had one word been changed, if they believe that there was a technical violation of the contract, which we don't agree with, she would have went through the same hearings. There was no rebuttable presumption that she was terminated. The same people would consider it. In fact, there was a dissenting vote in the Resident Oversight Committee. It was 17-1, but there was clearly this was not a sham process where there's a conspiracy to get Dr. Gould out with adequate process. There was somebody that's speaking up on behalf of her. Now, it's not very good odds in her favor, but it clearly was not a sham procedure.
What about the 2 months? I mean, it seems to me that we're arguing about a lot of things here, but really it comes down to consequential damages for not finishing out the first year. Is there a dispute of fact about whether she was told to turn in her badge and keys and et cetera before the end of the contract year?
I think after that April 27th date...
2 minutes.
After that April 27th date, Justice Zinner, there was a question of whether... there was factual dispute whether she was told that, yes. But even assuming that Dr. Kemp told her to do that, when you look at the factual record from Dr. Gould's testimony, from her presentation, and you go through what happened during those time frames, at most you just have her coming in and saying, what am I supposed to do, Dr. Kemp? And he says, under the apparent belief that she's quitting, is turn in your keys, dictation, that's what you need to do to finish. But ultimately, even if you would believe that that factual confusion during at that time frame is a material fact, ultimately we believe that that's overridden by the damages issue, and that she essentially has been awarded all that we believe she is entitled to if this case could have proceeded anyways.
What about consequential damages?
Under South Dakota law, appellees believe that you are restricted under the terms of the contract, that you're only allowed to claim what you would have received under the terms of the contract. And I'll give you a citation because this came up in the reply brief of appellants, but Bad Wound versus Lakota Wounds, it's 1999 SD 165. And so it's our position that South Dakota law does not allow consequential damages for the profits for the rest of your career. You can imagine the trial that would occur to try to see if, A, she would have completed the residency anyways or under some other program, and then whether she would have made it as a doctor when you have all these issues of whether she was qualified, and it would create an incredible factual difficulty in trying to try those type of damages in this case, and that's why South Dakota law limits you to what's allowed under the contract.
Your time has expired, Mr. Morgan. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Nichols, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson. A couple of things that I just want to say briefly about the contract and then move on to due process. But Justice Zinner's question anticipated, I guess, shed some light on, is there a question of fact regarding whether Dr. Gold was told to turn in the badge, the keys, the pager? And as I heard the presentation here, I believe the answer to that is no. Within 5 to 6 days of the April 27 letter, her rotations were suspended, and basically her affiliation with Center for Family Medicine was over. So that is the basis of why we've moved for summary judgment to the trial court, suggesting, hey, they breached their contract. And I understand the burden on summary judgment is very high. I would ask that, first and foremost, that we be granted summary judgment on that. Well, I guess that the trial court be reversed or affirmed. I'm not even sure what the trial court decided on that issue. It's part of the problem. But second to that, I believe there is, at a minimum, a question of fact as to whether or not Dr. Gall was terminated prior to completion of her first-year contract. And getting back to Justice Konenkamp, I apologize. I probably didn't answer the question as articulate as I would have liked earlier, but the dismissal paragraph of the employee handbook says when a resident is being considered for dismissal, and it doesn't say non-renewal, it doesn't say terminated, it doesn't say fired, it doesn't use some other verbiage. The verbiage is dismissal. They drafted it, and I believe that the handbook becomes part of the contract under South Dakota law, and if there's anything ambiguous about the term dismissal, I think that the ambiguity goes against the drafter. And clearly, the fact that Dr. Gold was terminated, or at least there's a question of fact, and under the standard this court is bound to fall, that has to go back to the jury to decide, at a minimum, whether or not the decision was made.
What can you say to counsel's comment that on April 6th there was a meeting and they told her that she was not going to be able to complete the year, or words to that effect?
Well, and again, if you look at the April 27 letter, though, it to the contrary, suggests that the opportunity to complete some type of first-year remedial program, or at least stay in the program, was at her, still up for deliberation, still being considered. And in fact, that document says we'll think about it in June. Well, how do you square that with, at the same time, telling her maybe you should go somewhere else? Why don't you leave? We're going to pull your rotations and effectively embargo any further participation with our program. And I think, again, that is the April 27 letter, something they drafted. Clearly a promise in writing to the extent as to what her future involvement with CFM was. And I think that creates an additional question of fact for the jury to consider whether Dr. Gall was promised or had some expectation, some property interest in continued participation within the Center for Family Medicine. I don't think in a growth industry that's 17% a year, it's too much to ask that they follow their contract. Now, I want to speak very briefly about due process. Again, there was some...
Yeah, CFM basically had the right to assign the duties under the contract, right? They could assign her to do anything.
The rotations for all residents, whether remedial or otherwise, was something that,
but
yes.
But they weren't committed to give her any specific rotation or even require her to show up to work.
Yes, but we have this promise again that maybe we're going to keep you around till June and then decide whether or not you'll be able to do something going forward. And I think that we have that reduced to writing. And although this is an at-will state, this court has held on numerous times that promises that the employer offers as inducement to the employee or for continued employment can form a basis for some type of relationship beyond at-will. Now, back to the due process question, I want to be clear. There was some reference in the brief that, well, we haven't properly demonstrated that due process even applies here. Again, they moved for summary judgment on the question of due process, and it was their burden to put something in the record to suggest that due process doesn't apply, even though they acknowledge that they receive public funds. What the United States Supreme Court has said in Brentwood Academy versus Tennessee Secondary School numerous times, that even a private organization that receives some public benefit can be bound by the 14th Amendment. And the Brentwood Academy case dealt with, I believe, textbooks that were donated from the public school district to a private school. But there's a difficult test. But I think that's something that the trial court needs to decide. That's not a question before this court. I believe there is enough evidence to suggest that they receive public funding, and then it would be for the trial court to decide whether or not the test, the public funding test, to connect the dots between the 14th Amendment and a private actor applies in this case. Now, the more important issue, and I think the one that the trial court really missed the boat on, was the question of, well, isn't the standard of due process much less in an academic setting? I don't think there's any question that even a student at a public school, some type of public entity, is entitled to at least some expectation of due process and has some interest, whether property or liberty, in continued education. The question is, what process is due? Of course, Cleveland versus Loudermill says that, and also Armstrong versus Manzo, that the due process must occur in a meaningful time, in a meaningful manner. In other words, it depends on the situation in which the process claim arises. Here, unlike the cases cited by the appellee in their brief, we're not talking about process arising out of an academic situation. Yes, they're saying, hey, we think that you weren't doing a good job, and our basis for wanting to terminate you going forward is because you aren't a good student. But the problem is the property interest that we're asserting here is a contract right, and it's bound in employment with the expectation that she would have some opportunity to defend herself before an adverse decision is made. Very different than an academic situation. And again, the Ross, I believe the case out of Minnesota, which was cited by both parties, indicates you look at the context in which the claim arises for a resident, because we are dealing with a hybrid, someone who is both an employee receiving some financial benefit for the work that they perform and also receiving some on-the-job apprenticeship training. Again, if you look at the context of which the claim arises here, it is based on her contract. And so even though there might be some question of the academic nature, we're not asking this court to trump their academic judgment. We're just simply asking that the contract be observed. And again, it's not appropriate to get into a guessing game. Well, isn't it a fact that our records show she wasn't doing a good job and she's going to be out anyway, so why go through the motions and having a jury decide what looks like to us to be a question of maybe some continued 4 weeks in the program? You can't do that. That's the jury's function under both a due process or contract argument. Again, the United States Supreme Court has said, first of all, you can't unring the bell. But once the protocol, once the process hasn't been followed, you got to go back to square one and have somebody else decide.
2 minutes.
And it may very well be that that's a realm of expert testimony, But again, that is for the jury to listen, gauge the facts, and decide whether or not Dr. Gohl has been damaged somewhere beyond the month or so of the continued employment. One other thing that I would just note, both under contract or due process, the standard isn't surprise. It's not, well, hey, Dr. Gohl, weren't you kind of alerted based on some of these notices that we provided? One thing that I would note with that as well is, as is the case in almost every case I've ever been a part of, the answer is usually somewhere in the middle. And Dr. Gohl believes that some of these notices were, there's more to the story, that she would have an opportunity to explain that it really isn't quite as it seems. That, again, is the purpose for having due process in the first place, that she has an opportunity not to just address Dr. Kemp or some other doctor that passes on this note that's compiled in some after-the-fact hearing, but have everybody sit in front of her with an attorney who speaks English as a primary language and have a chance to tell her side of the story before a very, very important decision is made that will affect her life forever. I see my time has expired. I thank you.
Thank you, counsel.